Sí.
It's a clean train. Everybody ride it.
There we go.
In Jesus.
Thank you. And I think we have Tony Leo. Are you there, Tony? No. Here we go. Mr. Leo.
Hello, Phil.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
You saw this demonstration. You went, I should call it a demonstration. You went to the Occupy for Palestine.
Yeah, I was at University of Toronto the night, the day they started the encampment.
What did you see there? What did you think of it?
It was amazing. It was inspiring, energizing. There was a very large crowd. They were very vocal in support of the demands of the students who were leading the encampment, and you know, it showed a great deal of good organization, smart messaging, reaching out and building support from a wide range of people, and you know, it mm-hmm. I felt they really knew what they were doing.
Did you chanting, speeches?
Yeah, there was
slogans.
A few people who were.
What were they doing when you were there?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, there was they had a good sound system. It was easy to hear. They had people who were speaking and leading chants. They were really focusing on the demands of the encampment. Disclose, divest, we won't stop, we won't rest was one of the main...
That's a good one.
And
disclose, divest, we won't... Something, we won't rest.
Yeah, we won't stop, we won't rest.
We won't stop, we won't rest. That's better than what I can
do. And, you know, they were chanting about stopping the genocide and supporting Free Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very clear, very good, very spirited. I was there for probably a bit more than an hour as it was getting dark. And at one point they asked everybody to take their phones out and turn on the flashlight app. And, you know, so it's reminiscent
great.
Of how people used to, I guess, wave their lighters at concerts, but it was all smartphones. But it made quite a spectacular display.
Good.
Because it was a very large crowd. I'm not sure how to estimate it, but hundreds of people, maybe over 1,000,
mm-hmm.
Were crowded around supporting the encampment.
Is it true you saw
hundreds of people inside, but there were many more people outside the barricades supporting the people inside?
Did you see Fred Hahn, the leader of CUPE?
There were a few people with union banners there, and one of them was Fred Hahn, the Ontario head of CUPE, proudly supporting the occupation. And I've run into Fred at a couple of the demonstrations against the Israeli assault on Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
I ran into him a week ago in front of Doug Ford's constituency office at a rally against the kafia ban in the Ontario legislature. And that was a notable event because it was called by the Ontario Federation of Labor, and there were a number of union members and leaders and speakers at that rally,
mm-hmm.
and Fred was one of them.
Now, what about unions and University of Toronto? Do you know anything about that? I understand Steelworkers has some portion of the employees here. And
I
heard there was a steelworker flag.
Yes. There are also CUPE members and Unifor members at the University of Toronto, but I didn't specifically see
mm-hmm.
Anything from them or haven't seen any statements from them. But overall, as this movement spreads amongst students across the United States and Canada, we have seen that, along with the students, the unions that represent students and academic workers, graduate assistants, even professors at a lot of these schools are supporting the protests. I know that's the case at Hamilton, where the CUPE local there has been in the front of the encampment that just started there, and it's certainly been true.
McMaster
across,
just did
the
you
United
say?
States.
I'm sorry. I just want to make sure is McMaster started now?
Yes, they did. Yeah.
And Unifor has members, and Unifor made a pretty good statement itself, right?
Yes, the leader of Unifor made a statement in support of the students and against the way they were being treated. And that's also the case with the leader of the UAW. And I think that it's even more noteworthy if we look at what's happening in the United States, because the UAW represents somewhere around 100,000 academic workers between teaching assistants, graduate assistants, sessional faculty, and other workers on campuses. It's grown tremendously over the last number of years, and they're really in the forefront of what's happening, because they're students, but they're also workers on the campus. Mm-hmm. And the UAW has been very strong in supporting the encampments and their own members.
Now,
to the extent that in a couple of locations, they have filed unfair labor practice complaints against the university administrations for attacking the encampments. Mm-hmm. And in one case, they're taking a strike vote. So they're considering going on strike against the university for the way they've treated the encampments.
Would you know what that campus, I heard that UCLA had a union. Would you know what campus it was where they were doing it?
It's UAW Local 872 has filed an unfair labor practice, and UAW Local 4811, and that's at UCLA, are moving towards a strike authorization vote.
Wow.
Yes.
That is really interesting, because, as you know, over the years, people used to say, oh, students and workers, whenever these issues start coming up, they should unite. But in past years, I would say there wasn't really much content, but it does appear to be now. And just to underline it, you've talked to us on this show about the fact that the rise of a really exemplary and groundbreaking leadership in the UAW, much of the support behind Mr. Sean Fain came from university employees, members of UAW, right?
A significant group, yes, absolutely. The academic section of the union voted overwhelmingly in favor of having one member, one vote, and then when they achieved that, they voted for the reform slate headed up by Sean Fain. And Sean Fain is one of the labor leaders who gave a very strong statement of support for the protests that are going on and against the repression that they're facing.
Yeah, he condemned what happened at Columbia and UCLA, right?
It's Columbia, UCLA, and many other universities have been facing.
Yeah, there is quite a list. I don't know why. Just going by headlines. We know from Jill Stein that something unpleasant happened at Washington University in St. Louis, and University of Texas is an ugly situation. Go ahead.
Sean Fain's statement was very brief. Maybe I just quickly
please,
read it.
If you have it, please read it.
Give people a flavor of what the position that's being taken by the UAW, which I think is really pushing the movement forward. And this was issued on May Day, and he says, the UAW will never support the mass arrest or intimidation of those exercising their right to protest, strike, or speak out against injustice. Our union has been calling for a ceasefire for 6 months. This war is wrong, and this response against students and academic workers, many of them UAW members, is wrong. We call on the powers that be to release the students and employees who have been arrested, and if you can't take the outcry, stop supporting this war.
That's a very good statement. By the way, Sean Fain is the most visible union leader in America right now, and his as they do these things of popular support, he probably has the best numbers of anybody in labor by a long shot.
For sure, and the bargaining against the auto companies, they took a very different stand than in the recent past, and it paid off, and it's led to a dramatic increase in organizing. They won the vote at the Volkswagen plant in Tennessee. They have the vote coming up at Mercedes in Alabama in a week, and at the same time, the other groups have been joining the UAW, including new sections of academic workers. They won a big contract battle with the Daimler Bus Group, which is in three southern states. So they are demonstrating the ability to mobilize their members, win contract demands, go on strike, take on these issues, and at the same time take a stand on these broader issues of international solidarity, which are crucially important, and they're connected. And there are some of the leaders of the UAW who have been pointing out that these issues are connected. And one of them is one of the regional directors, Brandon Mancilla, from Region 9A, and I would encourage people to read an interview with him that was in, I think it was in Nation magazine recently, why the UAW should stand in solidarity with Palestine. And he sets out a really strong position. He gives credit to unions like UE and UFCW and the postal workers who took good stands first, and that, and then the UAW followed along, and I think that he was part of the push. And there's another regional director, Mike Miller, who represents roughly the California region, and himself comes out of the academic section of the union, who has been pushing this. And they're connecting the fight of workers for justice at work and in their communities with the international issues of combating the way in which the U.S. government is supporting the assault on Gaza by arming Israel, and showing that those things are connected, and in the same way that we have seen in the past, when from Vietnam and on, where it was important for workers and students to be opposing what their governments were doing internationally.
Yeah, support each other. The working class has an investment in universities. Working class people are increasingly excluded from higher learning. They're being priced out. I mean, we have this horrible thing with the loan crisis for students. It's the union movement, the workers' movements, need to make sure that they are fighting for access to higher education, because it's been going in the opposite direction. By the way, I don't know if we said the name of the union, but a legendary union, the Longshoremen's Union, has also made a great statement, right? And are doing things.
Yes, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, ILWU, Local 10, is in the forefront, as they have been for a long time. People should remember that they took on the fight against apartheid South Africa and refused to load ships. In one famous example, in 1984, they voted not to unload a South African ship in San Francisco, and that lasted for 11 days. And they were doing that. It wasn't allowed under their contract, so I guess you could say it was an illegal action. But they carried it on. The ship was called the Ned Lloyd Kimberly, and they refused for 11 days to unload the goods from South Africa that were docked in San Francisco. And they've maintained that policy through the years. They took action against the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, including having a one-day strike in 2008 on May Day. Mm-hmm. They have refused to handle cargo from Israeli ships in 2010, in 2014, in 2021. And currently, they have passed resolutions calling for a ceasefire and an end to arms shipments to to Israel, and you know, very strong statements. They've passed a resolution which they're going to take to the their broader union. This is one local, but they've passed a resolution that's going to go to their locals' convention in June that calls on. Well, the final resolve is this, that the ILWU will refuse to handle military cargo to Israel as requested by the Palestinian General Federation of Trade Unions and seconded by the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, and as our union already did in 1978, refusing to load bomb parts for the Chilean military junta. And it is also did in 1980, refusing to load arms to the military junta of El Salvador, and will honor picket lines protesting the war on Gaza, as we have done repeatedly in the past. So that's
an impressive
union that was endorsed by Local 10, and that's going to be going to the ILWU convention in June.
That's quite a trend. I mean, this is not sort of piecemeal. This we're talking about. Thousands and thousands, if not millions, of organized workers. We're speaking to Tony Leo, and Tony, in the moments remaining, I think maybe I got 2 minutes. I want to ask you, tell us what your reaction is to the news that we're going to have another battery plant or whatever it is. Who's building this big battery thing? And we're only going to have to pay, I forget how many billions for it. What is that?
Yeah, the most recent one is Honda. Which says that they are investing, they claim, $15 billion to expand their operations in Alliston, Ontario, that will include a battery assembly operation and an electric vehicle assembly operation. And they're being supported by the federal and provincial governments to the tune of $5 billion. They claim that 1,000 jobs will be created, and so that means that the citizens of Ontario and Canada are contributing $5 million per job.
I thought they claimed that our terrible enemy, China, was the country that did that. We seem to be willing to shell out all kinds of money.
The total...
Public money.
So far, to do with the electric batteries and vehicles, is $43 billion. And that's to get an investment of $38 billion. So we're actually, the governments are contributing more than 100% of the costs of these investments. It's really quite bizarre. In fact,
I hope our donors are happy with what we're doing for them.
Yeah, in the case of Volkswagen, which is investing $7 billion, the subsidies from governments are going to be $14 billion. So that's 200%. Yeah. And in the case of Stellantis in Windsor, the battery operation there that is a joint venture with another company, it's a $5 billion investment, and they're going to get $15 billion in government money. So that's 300%.
Yikes. Tony, that's well, it's a revelation. We thank you very, very much for all this information. Tony Leo, Unifor, thank you very much.
Thanks, Phil.
This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I want to thank Winston and Pedro and Riley and 33, 45, 78, Steve Fruitman coming up.